Side 3. Chapter 6. Distance changes utterly when you take the world on foot. A mile becomes a long way. 2 miles, literally considerable. 10 miles, whopping. 50 miles, at the very limits of conception. The world, you realize, is enormous in a way that only you and a small community of fellow hikers know. Planetary scale is your little secret. Life takes on a neat simplicity, too. Time ceases to have any meaning. When it is dark, you go to bed, and when it is light, again, you get up. And everything in between is just in between. It's quite wonderful, really. You have no engagements, commitments, obligations, or duties, no special ambitions, and only the smallest, least complicated of wants. You exist in a tranquil tedium, serenely beyond the reach of exasperation, far removed from the seats of strife, as the early explorer and botanist William Bartram put it. All that is required of you is a willingness to trudge. There is no point in hurrying because you are not actually going anywhere. However far or long you plod, you are always in the same place, in the woods. It's where you were yesterday, where you will be tomorrow. The woods is one boundless singularity. Every bend in the path presents a prospect indistinguishable from every other. Every glimpse into the trees, the same tangled mass. For all you know, your route could describe a very large, pointless circle. In a way, it would hardly matter. At times, you become almost certain that you slabbed this hillside 3 days ago, crossed this stream yesterday, clambered over this fallen tree at least twice today already. But most of the time, you don't think. No point. Instead, you exist in a kind of mobile Zen mode, your brain like a balloon tethered with string, accompanying but not actually part of the body below. Walking for hours and miles becomes as automatic, as unremarkable as breathing. At the end of the day, you don't think, "Hey, I did 16 miles today," any more than you think, "Hey, I took 8,000 breaths today." It's just what you do. And so we walked, hour upon hour, over roller coaster hills, along knife-edge ridges and over grassy balds, through depthless ranks of oak, ash, chinkapin, and pine. The skies grew sullen and the air chillier, but it wasn't until the third day that the snow came. It began in the morning as thinly scattered flecks, hardly noticeable, but then the wind rose, then rose again, until it was blowing with an end-of-the-world fury that seemed to have even the trees in a panic. And with it came snow, great flying masses of it. By midday, we found ourselves plodding into a stinging, cold, hard-blowing storm. Soon after, we came to a narrow ledge of path along a wall of rock called Big Butt Mountain. Even in ideal circumstances, the path round Big Butt would have required delicacy and care. It was like a window ledge on a skyscraper, no more than 14 or 16 inches wide and crumbling in places, with a sharp drop on one side of perhaps 80 feet and long, looming stretches of vertical granite on the other. Once or twice I nudged foot-sized rocks over the side and watched with faint horror as they crashed and tumbled to improbably remote resting places. The trail was cobbled with rocks and threaded with wandering tree roots, against which we constantly stubbed and stumbled and veneered everywhere with polished ice under a thin layer of powdery snow. At exasperatingly frequent intervals, the path was broken by steep, thickly bouldered streams, frozen solid and ribbed with blue ice, which could only be negotiated in a crab-like crouch. And all the time, as we crept along on this absurdly narrow, dangerous perch, we were half-blinded by flying snow and jostled by gusts of wind, which roared through the dancing trees and shook us by our packs. This wasn't a blizzard. It was a tempest. We proceeded with painstaking deliberativeness, placing each foot solidly before lifting the one behind. Even so, twice Katz made horrifying, heartfelt, comic book noises as his footing went. "Hey!" noises, and "Yeah!" noises. And I turned to find him hugging a tree, feet skating, his expression bug-eyed and fearful. It was deeply unnerving. It took us over 2 hours to cover 0.6 of a mile of trail. By the time we reached solid ground at a place called Bear Pen Gap, the snow was 4 or 5 inches deep and accumulating fast. The whole world was white, filled with dime-sized snowflakes that fell at a slant before being caught by the wind and hurled in a variety of directions. We couldn't see more than 15 or 20 feet ahead. Often not that. The trail crossed a logging road, then led straight up Albert Mountain, a bouldered summit 5,250 feet above sea level, where the winds were so wild and angry that they hit the mountain with an actual walloping sound and forced us to shout to hear each other. We started up and hastily retreated. Hiking packs leave you with no recognizable center of gravity at the best of times. Here we were, literally being blown over. Confounded, we stood at the bottom of the summit and looked at each other. This was really quite grave. We were caught between a mountain we couldn't climb and a ledge we had no intention of trying to renegotiate. Our only apparent option was to pitch our tents, if we could in this wind, crawl in and hope for the best. I don't wish to reach for melodrama, but people have died in less trying circumstances. I dumped my pack and searched through it for my trail map. Appalachian trail maps are so monumentally useless that I had long since given up using them. AT maps vary somewhat, but most are on an abysmal scale of 1 to 100,000, which ludicrously compresses every kilometer of real world into a mere centimeter of map. Imagine a square kilometer of physical landscape and all that it might contain. Logging roads, streams, a mountaintop or two, perhaps a fire tower, a knob or grassy bald, the wandering AT, and maybe a pair of important side trails. And imagine trying to convey all that information on an area the size of the nail on your little finger. That's an AT map. Actually, it's far, far worse than that, because AT maps, for reasons that bewilder me beyond speculation, provide less detail than even their meager scale allows. For any 10 miles of trail, the maps will name and identify perhaps only 3 of the dozen or more peaks you cross. Valleys, lakes, gaps, creeks, and other important, possibly vital, topographical features are routinely left unnamed. Forest Service roads are often not included, and if included, inconsistently identified. Even side trails are frequently left off. There are no coordinates, no way of directing rescuers to a particular place, no pointers to towns just off the map's edge. These are, in short, seriously inadequate maps. In normal circumstances, this is merely irksome. Now, in a blizzard, it seemed closer to negligence. I dragged the map from the pack and fought the wind to look at it. It showed the trail as a red line. Nearby was a heavy, wandering black line, which I presumed to be the Forest Service road we stood beside, though there was no actual telling. According to the map, the road, if a road is what it was, started in the middle of nowhere and finished 6 miles later equally in the middle of nowhere, which clearly made no sense. Indeed, wasn't even possible. You can't start a road in the middle of forest. Earth-moving equipment can't spontaneously appear among the trees. Anyway, even if you could build a road that didn't go anywhere, why would you? There was obviously something deeply and infuriatingly wrong with this map. "Cost me $11," I said to Katz a little wildly, shaking the map at him and then crumpling it into an approximately flat shape and jabbing it into my pocket. "So what are we going to do?" he said. I sighed, unsure, then yanked the map out and examined it again. I looked from it to the logging road and back. "Well, it looks as if this logging road curves around the mountain and comes back near the trail on the other side. If it does, and we can find it, then there's a shelter we can get to. If we can't get through, I don't know. I guess we take the road back downhill to lower ground and see if we can find a place out of the wind to camp." I shrugged a little helplessly. "I don't know. What do you think?" Katz was looking at the sky, watching the flying snow. "Well, I think," he said thoughtfully, "that I'd like to have a long hot soak in a jacuzzi, a big steak dinner with a baked potato and lots of sour cream, and I mean lots of sour cream, And then sex with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders on a tiger skin rug in front of a roaring fire in one of those big stone fireplaces like you get in a lodge at a ski resort. You know the kind I mean? He looked at me. I nodded. That's what I'd like. But I'm willing to try your plan if you think it will be more fun. He flicked snow from his brow. Besides, it would be a shame to waste all this delightful snow. He issued a single bitter guffaw and returned to the hysterical snow. I hoisted my pack and followed. We plodded up the road, bent steeply, buffeted by winds. Where it settled, the snow was wet and heavy and getting so deep that soon it would be impassable, and we would have to take shelter whether we wanted to or not. There was no place to pitch a tent here, I noticed uneasily, only steep, wooded slope going up on one side and down on the other. For quite a distance, far longer than it seemed it ought to, the road stayed straight. Even if further on it did curve back near the trail, there was no certainty, or even perhaps much likelihood, that we would spot it. In these trees and this snow, you could be 10 feet from the trail and not see it. It would be madness to leave the logging road and try to find it. Then again, it was probably madness to be following a logging road to higher ground in a blizzard. Gradually and then more decidedly, the road began to hook round behind the mountain. After about an hour of dragging sluggishly through ever-deepening snow, we came to a high, windy, level spot where the trail, or at least a trail, emerged down the back of Albert Mountain and continued on into level woods. I regarded my map with bewildered exasperation. It didn't give any indication of this, whatever. But Cat spotted a white blaze 20 yards into the woods, and we whooped with joy. We had re-found the AT. A shelter was only a few 100 yards further on. It looked as if we would live to hike another day. The snow was nearly knee-deep now, and we were tired. But we all but pranced through it, and Cats whooped again when we reached an arrowed sign on a low limb that pointed down a side trail and said, Big Spring Shelter. The shelter, a simple wooden affair, open on one side, stood in a snowy glade, a little winter wonderland, 150 yards or so off the main trail. Even from a distance, we could see that the open side faced into the wind, and that the drifting snow was nearly up to the lip of the sleeping platform. Still, if nothing else, it offered at least a sense of refuge. We crossed the clearing, heaved our packs onto the platform, and in the same instant discovered that there were 2 people there already, a man and a boy of about 14. They were Jim and Heath, father and son. They were from Chattanooga, and they were cheerful, friendly, and not remotely daunted by the weather. They had come hiking for the weekend, they told us. I hadn't even realized it was a weekend, and knew the weather was likely to be bad, though not perhaps quite this bad, and so were well prepared. Jim had brought a big clear plastic sheet of the sort decorators use to cover floors, and was trying to rig it across the open front of the shelter. Cats, uncharacteristically, leapt to his assistance. The plastic sheet didn't quite reach, but we found that with one of our ground claws lashed alongside it, we could cover the entire front. The wind walloped ferociously against the plastic, and from time to time tore part of it loose, where it fluttered and snapped with a retort like gunshot, until one of us leapt up and fought it back into place. The whole shelter was in any case incredibly leaky of air. The plank walls and floors were full of cracks, through which icy wind and occasional blasts of snow shot. But we were infinitely snugger than we would have been outside. So we made a little home of it for ourselves, spread out our sleeping pads and bags, put on all the extra clothes we could find, and fixed dinner from a reclining position. Darkness fell quickly and heavily, which made the wildness outside seem even more severe. Jim and Heath had some chocolate cake, which they shared with us, a treat beyond heaven. And then the 4 of us settled down to a long, cold night on hard wood, listening to a banshee wind and the crash of angry branches. When I awoke, all was stillness, the sort of stillness that makes you sit up and take your bearings. The plastic sheet before me was peeled back a foot or so, and weak light filled the space beyond. Snow was over the top of the platform and lying an inch deep over the foot of my sleeping bag. I shooed it off with a toss of my legs. Jim and Heath were already stirring to life. Katz slumbered heavily on, an arm flung over his forehead, his mouth a great open hole. It was not quite six. I decided to go out to reconnoiter and see how stranded we might be. I hesitated at the platform's edge, then jumped out into the drift. It came up over my waist and made my eyes fly open where it slipped under my clothes and found bare skin, and pushed through it into the clearing, where it was slightly, but only slightly, shallower. Even in sheltered areas, under an umbrella of conifers, the snow was nearly knee-deep and tedious to churn through, but everywhere it was stunning. Every tree wore a thick cloak of white, every stump and boulder a jaunty snowy cap, and there was that perfect immense stillness that you get nowhere else but in a big wood after a heavy snowfall. Here and there clumps of snow fell from the branches, but otherwise there was no sound or movement. I followed the side trail up and under heavily bowed limbs to where it rejoined the AT. The AT was a plumped blanket of snow, round and bluish, in a long, dim tunnel of overbent rhododendrons. It looked deep and hard going. I walked a few yards as a test. It was deep and hard going. When I returned to the shelter, Katz was up, moving slowly and going through his morning groans, and Jim was studying his maps, which were vastly better than mine. I crouched beside him, and he made room to let me look with him. It was 6.1 miles to Wallace Gap and a paved road, old U.S. 64. A mile down the road from there was Rainbow Springs Campground, a private campsite with showers and a store. I didn't know how hard it would be to walk 7 miles through deep snow and had no confidence that the campground would be open this early in the year. Still, it was obvious this snow wasn't going to melt for days, and we would have to make a move sometime. It might as well be now, when at least it was pretty and calm. Who knew when another storm might blow in and really strand us? Jim had decided that he and Heath would accompany us for the first couple of hours, then turn off on a side trail called Long Branch, which descended steeply through a ravine for 2.3 miles and emerged near a car park where they had left their car. He had hiked the Long Branch Trail many times and knew what to expect. Even so, I didn't like the sound of it and asked him hesitantly if he thought it was a good idea to go off on a little-used side trail into goodness knows what conditions where no one would come across him and his son if they got in trouble. Katz, to my relief, agreed with me. "At least there's always other people on the AT," he said. "You don't know what might happen to you on a side trail." Jim considered the matter and said they would turn back if it looked bad. Katz and I treated ourselves to 2 cups of coffee, for warmth, and Jim and Heath shared with us some of their oatmeal, which made Katz intensely happy. Then we all set off together. It was cold and hard going. The tunnels of bowed rhododendrons, which often ran on for great distances, were exceedingly pretty, but when our packs brushed against them, they dumped volumes of snow onto our heads and down the back of our necks. The 3 adults took it in turns to walk in front, because the lead person always received the heaviest dumping, as well as having all the hard work of divvying holes in the snow. The Long Branch Trail, when we reached it, descended steeply through bowed pines. Too steeply, it seemed to me, to come back up if the trail proved impassable, and it looked as if it might. Katz and I urged them to reconsider, but Jim said it was all downhill and well marked, and he was sure it would be all right. "Hey, do you know what day it is?" said Jim suddenly, and seeing our blank faces supply the answer. "March the 21st. Our faces stayed blank. "First day of spring," he said. We smiled at the irony of it, shook hands all round, wished each other luck, and parted. Katz and I walked for 3 hours more, silently and slowly through the cold white forest, taking it in turns to break snow. At about 1 o'clock we came at last to Old 64, a lonesome, superannuated 2-lane road through the mountains. It hadn't been cleared, and there were no tire tracks through it. It was starting to snow again, steadily, prettily. We set off down the road for the campground, and had walked about a quarter of a mile when from behind there was the crunching sound of a motorized vehicle proceeding cautiously through snow. We turned to see a big Jeep-type car rolling up beside us. The driver's window hummed down. It was Jim and Heath. They had come to let us know they had made it, and to make sure we had likewise. "Thought you might like a lift to the campground," Jim said. We climbed gratefully in, filling their nice car with snow, and rode down to the campsite. Jim told us that they had passed it on the way up, and it looked open, but that they would take us to Franklin, the nearest town, if it wasn't. They had heard a weather forecast. More snow was expected over the next couple of days. They dropped us at the campground, it was open, and departed with waves. Rainbow Springs was a small private campsite with several small overnight cottages, a shower block, and a couple of other indeterminate buildings scattered around a big, level, open area clearly intended for camper vans and recreational vehicles. By the entrance, in an old white house, was the office, which was really a general store. We went in and found that every hiker for 20 miles was already there, several of them sitting around a wood stove eating chili or ice cream, and looking rosy-cheeked and warm and clean. Three or four of them we knew already. The campground was run by Buddy and Jensine Crossman, who seemed friendly and welcoming. If nothing else, it was probably not often that business was this good in March. I inquired about a cabin. Jensine stubbed out a cigarette and laughed at my naivety, which caused her a small coughing attack. "Honey, the cabins went 2 days ago. There's two places left in the bunkhouse. After that, people are going to have to sleep on floors." Bunkhouse is not a word I particularly want to hear at my time of life, but we had no choice. We signed in, were given two very small stiff towels for the shower, and trudged off across the grounds to see what we got for our $11 apiece. The answer was very little. The bunkhouse was basic and awesomely unlovely. It was dominated by 12 narrow wood bunks, stacked in tiers of three, each with a thin bear mattress and a grubby bear pillow lumpily filled with shreds of styrofoam. In one corner stood a pot-bellied stove, hissing softly, surrounded by a semicircle of limp boots and draped with wet woolen socks, which steamed foully. A small wooden table and a pair of broken-down easy chairs, both sprouting stuffing, completed the furnishings. Everywhere there was stuff. Tents, clothes, backpacks, rain covers hanging out to dry, dripping sluggishly. The floor was bare concrete, the walls uninsulated plywood. It was singularly uninviting, like camping in a garage. "Welcome to the Stalag," said a man with an ironic smile and an English accent. His name was Peter Fleming, and he was a lecturer at a college in New Brunswick, who had come south for a week's hiking, but like everyone else, had been driven in by the snow. He introduced us around. Each person greeted us with a friendly but desultory nod, and indicated which were the spare bunks, one on the top level, nearly up at the ceiling, the other on the bottom on the opposite side of the room. "Red Cross parcels come on the last Friday of the month, and there'll be a meeting of the escape committee at 1900 hours this evening. I think that's about all you need to know."
"And don't order the Philly cheese steak sandwich unless you want to puke all night," said a wan but heartfelt voice from a shadowy bunk in the corner.
"That's Tex," Fleming explained. We nodded. Kat selected the topmost bunk and set about the long challenge of trying to get into it. I turned to my own bunk and examined it with a kind of appalled fascination. If the mattress stains were anything to go by, a previous user had not so much suffered from incontinence as rejoiced in it. He had evidently included the pillow in his celebrations. I lifted it and sniffed it, then wished I hadn't. I spread out my sleeping bag, draped some socks over the stove, hung up a few things to dry, then sat on the edge of the bed and passed a pleasant half hour with the others, watching Katz's dogged struggle to the summit, which mostly involved deep grunts, swimming legs, and invitations to all onlookers and well-wishers to go fuck themselves. From where I sat, all I could see was his expansive butt and homeless lower limbs. His posture brought to mind a shipwreck victim, clinging to a square of floating wreckage on rough seas, or possibly someone who had been lifted unexpectedly into the sky by a weather balloon he was preparing to hoist. In any case, someone holding on for dear life in dangerous circumstances. I grabbed my pillow and climbed up alongside him to ask why he didn't just take the bottom bunk. His face was wild and flushed. I'm not even sure he recognized me at that moment.
"Because heat rises, buddy," he said. "And when I get up here, if I fucking ever do, I'm going to be toast."
I nodded. There was seldom any point in trying to reason with Katz when he was puffed out and fixated, and used the opportunity to switch pillows on him. Eventually, when it came unsustainably pathetic to watch, three of us pushed him home. He flopped heavily, and with an alarming crack of wood which panicked the poor quiet man in the bunk underneath, and announced he had no intention of leaving this spot until the snows had melted and spring had come to the mountains. Then he turned his back and went to sleep. I trudged through the snow to the shower block for the pleasure of dancing through ice water, then went to the general store and hung out by the stove with half a dozen others. There was nothing else to do. I ate two bowls of chili, the house speciality, and listened to the general conversation. This mostly involved Buddy and Jensine, bitching about the previous day's customers, but it was nice to hear some voices other than Katz's.
"You should have seen them," Jensine said with distaste, picking a fleck of tobacco off her tongue. "Didn't say please, didn't say thank you. Not like you guys. You guys are a breath of fresh air in comparison, believe me. And they made a complete pig pen of the bunkhouse, didn't they, Buddy?"
She passed the baton to Buddy.
"Took me an hour to clean it this morning," he said grimly,
which surprised me because the bunkhouse didn't look as if it had been cleaned this century.
"There were puddles all over the floor, and somebody, I don't know who, left a filthy old flannel shirt which was just disgusting. And they burned all the firewood. 3 days' worth of firewood I took down there yesterday, and they burned every stick of it."
"We were real glad to see them go," said Jensine, "real glad. Not like you guys. You guys are a breath of fresh air, believe me."
Then she went off to answer a ringing phone. I was sitting next to one of the three kids from Rutgers University, whom we had been running into off and on since the second day. They had a cabin now, but had been in the bunkhouse the night before. He leaned over and in a whisper said,
"She said the same thing yesterday about the people the day before. She'll be saying the same thing tomorrow about us. Do you know there were 15 of us in the bunkhouse last night?"
15, I repeated in a tone of wonder. It was intolerable enough with 12.
"Where on earth did the extra 3 sleep?" "On the floor. And they were still charged $11 for it. How's your chili?"
I looked at it as if I hadn't thought about it, as in fact I hadn't. Pretty terrible, actually. He nodded.
"Wait till you've been eating it for 2 days.
When I left to walk back to the bunkhouse, it was still snowing, but peacefully. Katz was awake and up on one elbow, smoking a cadged cigarette, and asking people to pass things up to him, scissors, a bandana, matches, as the need arose, and to take them away again as he finished with them. 3 people stood at the window watching the snow. The talk was all of the weather. There was no telling when we would get out of here. It was impossible not to feel trapped. We spent a wretched night in our bunks, faintly lit by the dancing glow of the stove, which the timid man, unable or reluctant to sleep with a restless mass of cats bowing the slats just above his head, diligently kept stoked, and wrapped in a breathy, communal symphony of nighttime noises, sighs, weary exhalations, dredging snores, a steady, dying moan from the man who had eaten the Philly cheesesteak sandwich, the monotone hiss of the stove, like the soundtrack of an old movie, and woke, stiff and unrested, to a gloomy dawn of falling snow and the dispiriting prospect of a long, long day with nothing to do but hang out at the camp store or lie in a bunk bed reading old Reader's Digests that filled a small shelf by the door. Then word came that an industrious youth named Zach from one of the cabins had somehow got to Franklin and rented a minivan and was offering to take anyone to town for $5. There was a virtual stampede. To the dismay and disgust of Buddy and Jensine, practically everyone paid up and left. 14 of us packed into the minivan and started on the long descent to Franklin in a snowless valley far below. And so we had a little holiday in Franklin.
which was small, dull, and cautiously unattractive, but mostly dull. The sort of place where you find yourself, for want of anything better to do, strolling out to the lumber yard to watch guys on forklifts shunting wood about. There wasn't a thing in the way of diversions. Nowhere to buy a book or even a magazine that didn't involve speedboats, customized cars, or guns and ammo. The town was full of hikers like us who had been driven down from the hills and had nothing to do but hang out listlessly in the diner or launderette and two or three times a day make a pilgrimage to the far end of Main Street to stare forlornly at the distant, snow-draped, patently impassable peaks. The outlook was not good. There were rumors of 7-foot drifts in the Smokies. It could be days before the trail was passable again. I was plunged into a restless depression by this, heightened by the realization that Katz was verily in heaven at the prospect of several days idling in a town, on vacation from purpose and exertion, trying out various attitudes of repose. To my intense vexation, it even bought a TV guide to plan his viewing more effectively over the coming days. I wanted to get back on the trail, to knock off miles. It was what we did. Besides, I was bored to a point somewhat beyond being bored out of my mind. I was reading restaurant placemats, then turning them over to see if there was anything on the back. At the lumberyard, I talked to workmen through the fence. Late on the third afternoon, I stood in a Burger King and studied with absorption the photographs of the manager and his executive crew, reflecting on the curious fact that people who go into hamburger management always look as if their mother slept with Goofy. Then slid one pace to the right to examine the Employee of the Month awards. It was then I realized I had to get out of Franklin. 20 minutes later, I announced to Katz that we were returning to the trail in the morning. He was, of course, astounded and dismayed. "But it's the X-Files on Friday," he sputtered. "I just bought cream soda." "The disappointment must be crushing," I replied with a thin, heartless smile. "But the snow! We'll never get through!" I gave a shrug that was meant to look optimistic, but was probably closer to indifferent. "We might," I said. "But what if we don't? What if there's another blizzard? We were very lucky, if you ask me, to escape with our lives last time." He looked at me with desperate eyes. "I've got 18 cans of cream soda in my room," he blurted, and then wished he hadn't. I arched an eyebrow. 18? Were you planning to settle here? "It was on special," he muttered defensively, and retreated into a sulk. "Look, Stephen, I'm sorry to spoil your festive arrangements, but we didn't come all the way down here to drink pop and watch TV. "Didn't come down here to die, either," he said, but he argued no more. So we went, and were lucky. The snow was deep, but passable. Some lone hiker, even more impatient than I, had pushed through ahead of us and compacted the snow a little, which helped. It was slick on the steep climbs. Katz was forever sliding back, falling down, cursing mightily, and occasionally on higher ground we had to detour round expansive drift fields, but there was never a place where we couldn't get through. And the weather perked up. The sun came out. The air grew milder and heavier. The little mountain streams became lively with a tumble and gurgle of meltwater. I even heard the tentative twitter of birds. Above 4,500 feet, the snow lingered and the air felt refrigerated, but lower down, the snow retreated in daily bounds, until by the third day it was no more than scrappy patches on the darkest slopes. It really wasn't bad at all, though Katz refused to admit it. I didn't care. I just walked. I was very happy. Chapter 7. For 2 days, Katz barely spoke to me. On the second night, at 9 p.m., an unlikely noise came from his tent, the punctured air click of a beverage can being opened, and he said in a pugnacious tone, "Do you know what that was, Bryson? Cream soda. You know what else? I'm drinking it right now, and I'm not giving you any. And you know what else? It's delicious." There was a slurpy, intentionally amplified drinking noise.
Mmm, delightful.
Another slurp. And do you know why I'm drinking it now?
Because it's 9 p.m., time for the X-Files, my favorite program of all time.
There was a long moment's drinking noise, the sound of a tent zip parting, the tink of an empty can landing in undergrowth, the tent zip closing.
Man, that was so good. Now fuck you and good night.
And that was the end of it. In the morning, he was fine. Katz never really did get into hiking, though goodness knows he tried. From time to time, I believe, he glimpsed that there was something, some elusive, elemental something, that made being out in the woods almost gratifying. Occasionally, he would exclaim over a view or regard with admiration some passing marvel of nature, but mostly to him, hiking was a tiring, dirty, pointless slog between distantly spaced comfort zones. I, meanwhile, was wholly, mindlessly, very contentedly absorbed with the business of just pushing forward. My congenital distraction sometimes fascinated him, and sometimes amused him, but mostly it just drove him crazy. Late on the morning of the fourth day after leaving Franklin, I was perched on a big green rock waiting for Katz after it dawned on me that I had not seen him for some time. When at last he came along, he was even more disheveled than usual. There were twigs in his hair, an arresting new tear in his flannel shirt, and a trickle of dried blood in his forehead. He dropped his pack and sat heavily beside me with his water bottle, took a long swig, mopped his forehead, checked his hand for blood, and finally said in a conversational tone, "How did you get round that tree back there?"
"What tree?"
"The fallen tree, back there, the one across the ledge." I thought for a minute.
"I don't remember it."
"What do you mean you don't remember it? It was blocking the path, for crying out loud."
I thought again, harder, and shook my head with a look of feeble apology. I could see he was heading towards exasperation.
"Just back there, 400-500 yards.
He paused, waiting for a spark of recognition, and couldn't believe that it wasn't forthcoming.
"One side a sheer cliff, the other side a thicket of brambles with no way through, and in the middle a big fallen tree. You had to have noticed it."
"Whereabouts was it exactly?" I asked, as if stalling for time. Katz couldn't contain his irritation.
"Just back there, for Christ's sake! One side cliff, the other side brambles, and in the middle a big fallen down oak with about this much clearance."
He held his hand about 14 inches off the ground and was dumbfounded by my blank look.
"Bryson, I don't know what you're taking, but I gotta have some of it. The tree was too high to climb over and too low to crawl under, and there wasn't any way around it. It took me a half hour to get over it, and I cut myself all to shit in the process. How could you not remember it?"
"It might come to me after a bit," I said hopefully. Cat shook his head sadly. I was never entirely certain why he found my mental absences so irritating, whether he thought I was being willfully obtuse to annoy him, or whether he felt I was unreasonably cheating hardship by failing to notice it. But I made a private pledge to remain alert and fully conscious for a while, so as not to exasperate him. This was a fortunate thing, because 2 hours later we had one of those hallelujah moments that come but rarely on the trail. We were walking along the lofty breast of a mountain called High Top, when the trees parted at a granite overlook and we were confronted with an arresting prospect. A sudden new world of big, muscular, comparatively craggy mountains, steeped in haze and nudged at the distant margins by moody-looking clouds, at once deeply beckoning and rather awesome. We had found the Smokies. Far below, squeezed into a narrow valley, was Fontana Lake, a long, fjord-like arm of pale green water. At the lake's western end, where the Little Tennessee River flows into it, stands a big hydroelectric dam, 480 feet high, built by the Tennessee Valley authorities in the 1930s. It's the biggest dam in America east of the Mississippi, and something of an attraction for people who like concrete in volume. We hastened down the trail to it, as we had an inkling that there was a visitor center there, which meant the possibility of a cafeteria and other gratifying contacts with the developed world. At the very least, we speculated excitedly,
There would be vending machines and restrooms where we could wash and get fresh water, look in a mirror, briefly be groomed and civilized. There was indeed a visitor center, but it was shut. A peeling notice taped to the glass said it wouldn't open for another month. The vending machines were empty and unplugged, and to our dismay, even the restrooms were locked. Katz found a tap on an outside wall and turned it, but the water had been shut off. We sighed, exchanged stoic, long-suffering looks, and pushed on. The trail crossed the lake on the top of the dam. The mountains before us didn't so much rise from the lake as rear from it, like startled beasts. It was clear at a glance that we were entering a new realm of magnificence and challenge. The far shore of the lake marked the southern boundary of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Ahead lay 800 square miles of dense, steeply mountainous forest, with 7 days and 71 miles of rigorous hiking before we came out the other end and could dream again of cheeseburgers, cokes, flush toilets, and running water. It would have been nice, at the very least, to have set off with clean hands and faces. I hadn't told Katz, but we were about to traverse 16 peaks above 6,000 feet, including Klingman's Dome, the highest point on the AT at 6,643 feet, just 41 feet less than nearby Mount Mitchell, the highest mountain in the eastern United States. I was eager and excited. Even Katz seemed cautiously keen, for there seemed a good deal to be excited about. For one thing, we had just picked up our third state, Tennessee, which always brings a sense of achievement on the trail. For nearly its whole length through the Smokies, the AT marks the boundary between North Carolina and Tennessee. I like this very much, the idea of being able to stand with my left foot in one state and my right foot in the other whenever I wanted, which was often, or to choose at rest breaks between sitting on a log in Tennessee and a rock in North Carolina, or to pee across state lines, or many other variations. Then there was the excitement of all the new things we might see in these rich, dark, storied mountains, giant salamanders and towering tulip trees, and the famous jack-o'-lantern mushroom, which glows at night with a greenish phosphorescent light called foxfire. Perhaps we would even see a bear, downwind, from a safe distance, oblivious of me, interested exclusively in cats, if either of us. Above all, there was the hope, the conviction, that spring could not be far off, that every passing day had to bring us closer to it, and that here, in the natural Eden of the Smokies, it would surely at last burst forth. For the Smokies are indeed a very Eden. We were entering what botanists like to call the finest mixed mesophytic forest in the world. The Smokies harbor an astonishing range of plant life, over 1,500 types of wildflower, 1,000 varieties of shrub, 530 mosses and lichen, 2,000 types of fungi. They are home to 130 native species of tree. The whole of Europe has just 85. They owe this lavish abundance to the deep, loamy soils of their sheltered valleys, known locally as coves, to their warm, moist climate, which produces the natural bluish haze from which they get their name, and above all, to the happy accident of the Appalachians' north-south orientation. During the last ice age, you see, as glaciers and ice sheets spread down from the Arctic, northern flora all over the world naturally fled southwards. In Europe, untold numbers of native species were crushed against the impassable barrier of the Alps and its cousins and fell into extinction. In eastern North America, there was no such impediment to retreat. So trees and other plants found their way through river valleys and over the mountains until they arrived at a congenial refuge in the Smokies, and there they have remained ever since. When at last the ice sheets drew back, the native northern trees began the long process of returning to their former territories. Some, like the white cedar and rhododendron, are only now reaching home, a reminder that, geologically speaking, the ice sheets have only just gone. Rich plant life naturally brings rich animal life. The Smokies are home to 67 varieties of mammal, over 200 types of bird, and 80 species of reptile and amphibian,
all larger numbers than are found in comparable-sized areas almost anywhere else in the temperate world. Above all, the Smokies are famous for their bears. There are an estimated 400 to 600 black bears in the park. Not a large number, but they are a chronic problem, because so many of them have lost their fear of people. Almost 9 million people a year come to the Smokies, many of them to picnic. So bears have learned to associate people with food. Indeed, to them, people are overweight creatures in baseball caps who spread lots and lots of food out on picnic tables and then shriek a little and waddle off to get their video cameras when old Mr. Bear comes along and climbs onto the table and starts devouring their potato salad and chocolate cake. Since the bear doesn't mind being filmed, and indeed seems indifferent to his audience, pretty generally some fool will come up to it and try to stroke it, or feed it a cupcake or something. There was one recorded instance of a woman smearing honey on her toddler's fingers so that the bear would lick it off for the video camera. Failing to understand this, the bear ate the baby's hand. When this sort of thing happens, and about a dozen people a year are injured, usually at picnic sites, usually by doing something dumb, or when a bear becomes persistent or aggressive, park rangers shoot it with a tranquilizer dart, truss it up, and take it into the depths of the backcountry, far from roads and picnic sites, and let it loose. Of course, by now, the bear has become thoroughly habituated both to human beings and to human beings' food. And whom will they find to take food from out in the backcountry? Why, me and cats, of course, and others like us. The annals of Appalachian trail hikes are full of tales of hikers being mugged by bears in the backcountry of the Smokies. And so, as we plunged into the steep, dense, covering woods of Shuckstack Mountain, I stayed closer than usual to Katz and carried my walking stick like a cosh. He thought I was a fool, of course. The true creature of the Smokies, however, is the reclusive and little-appreciated salamander. There are 25 varieties of salamander in the Smokies, more than anywhere else on Earth. Salamanders are interesting, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. To begin with, they're the oldest of all land vertebrates. When creatures first crawled from the seas, this is what came up, and they haven't changed a great deal since. Some varieties of Smoky salamander haven't even evolved lungs. They breathe through their skin. Most salamanders are tiny, only an inch or two long, but the rare and startlingly ugly hellbender salamander can attain lengths of over 2 feet. I ached to see a hellbender. Even more varied and underappreciated than the salamander is the freshwater mussel. 300 types of mussel, a third of the world's total, live in the Smokies. Smokies mussels have terrific names, like purple wartyback, shiny pigtoe, and monkey-faced pearly mussel. Unfortunately, that is where all interest in them ends. Because they are so little regarded, even by naturalists, mussels have vanished at an exceptional rate. Nearly half of all Smokies mussel species are endangered. 12 are thought to be extinct. This ought to be a little surprising in a national park. I mean, it's not as if mussels are flinging themselves under the wheels of passing cars. Still, the Smokies seem to be in the process of losing most of their mussels. The National Park Service actually has something of a tradition of making things extinct. Bryce Canyon National Park is perhaps the most interesting, certainly the most enthusiastic example. It was founded in 1923, and in less than half a century, under the Park Service's careful stewardship, had lost 7 species of mammal. The white-tailed jackrabbit, prairie dog, pronghorn antelope, flying squirrel, beaver, red fox, and spotted skunk. Quite an achievement. Altogether, 42 species of mammal have disappeared from America's national parks this century. Here in the Smokies, not far from where Katz and I now trod, the Park Service in 1957 decided to reclaim Abrams Creek, a tributary of the Little Tennessee River, for rainbow trout. To that end, biologists dumped extravagant quantities of a poison called rotenone into 15 miles of creek. Within hours, tens of thousands of dead fish were floating on the surface like autumn leaves. What a proud moment that must be for a trained naturalist. Among the 31 species of Abrams Creek fish that were wiped out was one called the Smoky Mad Tom, which scientists had never seen before. Thus, the Park Service biologists manage the wonderfully unusual accomplishment of discovering and eradicating a new species of fish in the same instant. In 1980, another colony of smoky mad toms was found in a nearby stream. Of course, that was 40 years ago, and such foolishness would be unthinkable in these more enlightened times. Today, the National Park Service employs a much more subtle approach to endangering wildlife, neglect. It spends almost nothing, less than 3% of its budget, on research of any type, which is why no one knows how many mussels are extinct or even why they are going extinct. Everywhere you look in the eastern forests, trees are dying in colossal numbers. In the Smokies, over 90% of Fraser firs, a noble tree unique to the southern Appalachian highlands, are sick or dying from a combination of acid rain and the depredations of an insect called the balsam woolly adelgid. Ask a park official what they are doing about it, and he will say, "We are monitoring the situation closely." For this, read, "We are watching them die." Or consider the grassy balds. Treeless, meadowy expanses of mountaintop, up to 250 acres in extent, which are quite unique to the southern Appalachians. No one knows why the balds are there, or how long they have existed, or why they appear on some mountains but not others. Some believe that they are natural features, perhaps relics of lightning fires, and some that they are man-made, burned or cleared to provide land for summer grazing. What is certain is that they are central to the character of the Smokies. To climb for hours through cool, dark forest and emerge at last onto the liberating open space of a sunny bald under a dome of blue sky with views to every horizon is an experience not to be forgotten. But they are far more than just grassy curiosities. According to the writer Hiram Rogers, grassy balds cover just 0.015% of the Smokies landscape, but hold 29% of its flora. For unknown numbers of years, they were used first by Indians and then by European settlers for grazing summer livestock. But now, with graziers banished and the Park Service doing nothing, woody species like hawthorn and blackberry are steadily reclaiming the mountaintops. Within 20 years, there may be no balds left in the Smokies. 90 plant species have disappeared from the balds since the park was opened in the 1930s. At least 25 more are expected to go in the next few years. There is no plan to save them. Now, you might conclude from this that I don't much admire the Park Service and its people, and that's not exactly true. I never met a ranger who wasn't helpful and dedicated and generally well-informed. Mind you, I hardly ever met a ranger, because most of them have been let go, but the ones I encountered were entirely all right. No, my problem is not with the people on the ground. It is with the Park Service itself. A lot of people point out in defense of the national parks that they have been starved of funds, and this is indubitably so. Adjusted for inflation, the Park Service budget today is $200 million a year less than it was a decade ago. In consequence, even as visitor numbers have soared from 207 million in 1983 to nearly 300 million today, campsites and interpretation centers have been shut, warden numbers slashed, and essential maintenance deferred to a positively ludicrous degree. By 1997, the repair backlog for the national parks had reached $6 billion. All quite scandalous. But consider this. In 1991, as its trees were dying, its buildings crumbling, its visitors being turned away from campgrounds it could not afford to keep open, and its employees being laid off in record numbers, the National Park Service threw a 75th anniversary party for itself in Vail, Colorado. It spent $500,000 on the event. That may not be quite as moronically negligent as tipping hundreds of gallons of poison into a wilderness stream, but it is certainly in the right spirit. But hey, let's not lose our perspective here. The Smokies achieved their natural splendor without the guidance of a National Park Service and don't actually need it now. Indeed, given the Park Service's bizarre and erratic behavior throughout its history, here's another one for you. In the 1960s, it invited the Walt Disney Corporation to build an amusement complex in Sequoia National Park in California. It is perhaps not an altogether bad idea to starve it of funds. I am almost certain that if that $200 million a year were restored to the budget, nearly all of it would go into building more car parks and RV facilities, not into saving trees, and certainly not into restoring the precious, lovely, grassy balds. It is actually Park Service policy to let the balds vanish. Having got everyone agitated by interfering with nature for years, it is decided now not to interfere with nature at all, even when that interference would be demonstrably beneficial. I tell you, these people are a wonder. Dusk was settling in when we reached Birch Spring Gap Shelter, standing on a slope beside a muddy stream a couple of hundred feet downhill from the trail. In the silvery half-light, it looked wonderful. In contrast to the utilitarian plywood structures found elsewhere on the trail, the shelters of the Smokies were solidly built of stone, in an intentionally quaint, rustic style. So from a distance, Birch Spring Gap Shelter had the snug, homey, inviting look of a cabin. Up close, however, it was somewhat less enthralling. The interior was dark and leaky, with a mud floor like chocolate pudding, a cramped and filthy sleeping platform, and scraps of wet litter everywhere. Water ran down the inside of the walls and trickled into pools on the sleeping ledge. Outside, there was no picnic table, as at most other shelters, and no privy. Even by the austere standards of the Appalachian Trail, this was grim. But at least we had it to ourselves. Like other AT shelters, it had an open front. I never really understood the thinking behind this, but this one was covered with a modern chain-link fence. A sign on the fence said, "Bears are active in this area. Do not leave door open." Interested to see just how active, I had a look at the shelter register while cats boiled water for noodles. Every shelter has a register in which visitors make diary-like entries on the weather or their state of mind, if any, and note any unusual occurrences. This one mentioned only a couple of odd bear-like noises outside in the night, but what really caught the attention of the shelter's chroniclers was the unusual liveliness of its resident mice and even rats, and this, I can now attest, was so. From the moment we put our heads down that night, there were the scurryings and scutterings of rodents. They were absolutely fearless, and scampered freely over our bags and even across our heads. Cursing furiously, Katz banged around at them with his water bottle and whatever else came to hand. Once, I turned on my headlamp to find a pack mouse on top of my sleeping bag, high up on my chest, not 6 inches from my chin, sitting up on its haunches and regarding me with a gimlet eye. Reflexively, I hit the bag from inside, flipping him into a startled oblivion.
"Got one!"
cried Katz. "Me too," I said rather proudly. Katz was scrabbling around on his hands and knees as if trying to pass for a mouse himself, enlivening the dark with a flying flashlight beam and pausing from time to time to hurl a boot or bang down his water bottle. Then he would crawl back in his bag, be still for a time, curse abruptly, fling off encumbrances, and repeat the process. I buried myself in my bag and pulled the drawstring tight over my head. And thus passed the night with repeated sequences of cats being violent, followed by silence, followed by scamperings, followed by cats being violent. I slept surprisingly well, all things considered. I expected cats to wake in a foul temper, but in fact he was chipper.
"There's nothing like a good night's sleep." And that was nothing like a good night's sleep, he announced when he stirred, and gave an appreciative snort.
His happiness, it turned out, was because he had killed 7 mice and was feeling very proud, not to say pumped up and gladiatorial. Some fur and a nubbin of something pink and pulpy still adhered to the bottom of his water bottle, I noticed when he raised it to his lips. Occasionally it troubled me. I presume it must trouble all hikers from time to time. Just how far one strays from the normal measures of civility on the trail. This was such a moment. Outside, fog was stealing in, filling the spaces between the trees. It was not an encouraging morning. A drizzle hung in the air when we set off, and before long it had turned into a steady, merciless, deadfall rain. Rain spoils everything. There is no pleasure in walking in waterproofs. There is something deeply dispiriting about the stiff rustle of nylon and the endless, curiously amplified patter of rain on fabric. Worst of all, you don't even stay dry. The waterproofs keep out the rain, but make you sweat so much that soon you are clammily sodden. By afternoon, the trail was a running stream. My boots gave up the will to stay dry. I was soaked through and squelching with every step. It rains up to 120 inches a year in some parts of the Smokies. That's 10 feet. That's a lot of rain. We had a lot of it now. We walked 9.7 miles to Spence Field Shelter, a modest distance even for us, but we were wet through and chilled, and anyway, it was too far to hike to the next one. The Park Service, why does this seem so inevitable, imposes a host of petty, inflexible, exasperating rules on AT hikers. Among them, that you must move smartly forward at all times, never stray from the trail, and camp each night at a shelter. It means effectively not only that you must walk a prescribed distance each day, but then spend the night penned up with strangers. We peeled off the worst of our wet clothes and rooted for dry ones in our packs, but even stuff from deep in the middle felt damp. There was a stone fireplace built into the shelter wall, and some kindly soul had left a pile of twigs and small logs by the side. Cats tried to light a fire, but everything was so wet that it wouldn't burn. Even his matches wouldn't strike. Cats exhaled in disgust and gave up. I decided to make some coffee to warm us up, and the stove proved equally temperamental. As I fiddled with it, there was the singing rustle of nylon from without, and two young women entered, blinking and bedraggled. They were from Boston, and had hiked in on a side trail from Cade's Cove. A minute or two later, four guys on spring break from Wake Forest University came in. Then a lone young hiker who proved to be our acquaintance, Jonathan, and finally a couple of bearded middle-aged guys. After 4 or 5 days in which we had seen scarcely a soul, suddenly we were inundated with company. Everyone was considerate and friendly, but there was no escaping the conclusion that we were hopelessly overcrowded. It occurred to me, not for the first time, how delightful, how truly delightful it would be if Mackay's original vision had been realized, if the shelters along the trail were proper hostels, with hot showers, individual bunks, with curtains for privacy and reading lights, please, and a resident caretaker cook who would keep a cheery fire dancing in the grate and invite us any minute now to take our places at a long table for a dinner of stew and dumplings, cornbread, and, oh, let us say, peach cobbler. Outside there would be a porch with rocking chairs, where you could sit and smoke your pipe and watch the sun sink into the lovely distant hills. What bliss it would be! I was perched on the edge of the sleeping platform, lost in a little reverie along these lines, and absorbed with trying to get a small volume of water to boil, quite happy, really, when one of the middle-aged guys drifted over and introduced himself as Bob. I knew, with a sinking heart, that we were going to talk equipment. I could just see it coming. I hate talking equipment.
"So, what made you buy a Gregory pack?" he said.
"Well, I thought it would be easier than carrying everything in my arms." He nodded thoughtfully, as if this were an answer worth considering, then said, "I've got a Kelty." I wanted to say, ache to say, "Well, here's an idea to try to get a hold of, Bob. I don't remotely give a shit." But talking equipment is one of those things you just have to do, like chatting to your mother's friends in the supermarket. So I said, "Oh, yeah? You happy with it?"
"Oh, yeah," was the deeply sincere reply. "Tell you why."
He brought it over to show me its features, its snap pockets, its map pouch, its general miraculous ability to hold contents. He was particularly proud of a drop-down inner stowage pouch, bulging with little plastic bottles of vitamins and medicines with a transparent window built into it.
"It lets you see what you've got in there without having to undo the zipper," he explained, and looked at me with an expression that invited staggered admiration.
Just at that moment, Katz stepped up. He was eating a carrot. Nobody could catch food like cats, and was about to ask me something, but when his eye lit on Bob's transparent pouch, he said,
"Hey, look, a pouch with a window.
Is that for people who are so stupid they can't figure out how to get it open?"
"Actually, it's a very useful feature," said Bob in a carefully measured tone. "It lets you check the contents without having to undo the zipper."
Katz gave him a genuinely incredulous look.
What, like you're so busy on the trail you can't spare the 3 seconds it takes to open a zipper and look inside?
He turned to me.
These college kids are willing to trade Pop-Tarts for Snickers. What do you think?
Well, I actually find it quite useful, Bob said quietly to himself. But he took his pack away and bothered us no more.
I'm afraid my equipment conversations nearly always ended up like that somehow, with a talker retiring with hurt feelings and a piece of formerly prized equipment cradled to his chest. It was never my wish, believe me.
The Smokies went downhill from there. We walked for 4 days, and the rain fell tirelessly, with an endless typewriter patter. The trail everywhere became boggy and slick. Puddles filled every dip and trough. Mud became a feature of our lives. We trudged through it, stumbled and fell in it, knelt in it, set our packs down in it, left a streak of it on everything we touched. And always, when you moved, there was the maddening, monotonous sound of your nylon going whiss, 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 until you wanted to take a gun and shoot it. I didn't see a bear, didn't see a salamander, didn't see foxfire, didn't see anything, actually. Just perpetual dribbles and droplets of rain adhering to my glasses. Each night we stopped in leaky byres and cooked and lived with strangers, crowds of them, all cold and damp and shuffling and gaunt and half mad from the ceaseless rain and the cheerlessness of wet hiking. It was awful. And the worse the weather got, the more crowded the shelters grew. It was spring break, half term, at colleges all over the East, and scores of young people had had the idea to come hiking in the Smokies. The Smokies shelters are supposed to be for thru-hikers, not casual drop-ins, and words were sometimes exchanged. It was not like the AT at all. It was worse than awful. By the third day, Katz and I both had nothing dry and were shivering constantly. We slopped up to the summit of Klingman's Dome, a high point of the trip by all accounts, with views in clear weather to make the heart take wing, and saw nothing, nothing whatever, but the dim shapes of dying trees in a sea of swirling fog. We were soaked and filthy, desperately needed a launderette, clean, dry clothes, a square meal, and a Ripley's Believe It or Not museum. It was time to go to Gatlinburg.
End of side 3.